For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
My dear brothers and sisters, thank you for coming out and being with me this evening. Americans are good at a lot of things. I mean, we're pretty good at sports, for example. I think we're really off the charts at inventions. Many of the inventions that are used around the world were American inventions. And there are a number of things I think Americans are good at. But for 50 years, there is something that Americans have been really, really bad at. And that's at being happy. The leading expert on happiness in the United States is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania named Martin Seligman. Seligman has done research as a research psychologist for 35 years on the subject of happiness. That's his specialization. In the mid-1980s, Seligman published an article in Psychology Today called Boomer Blues. And it was a study of my generation, the baby boom generation, the 60s generation, in comparison with the generation of my parents and my grandparents and great-grandparents. He discovered that in the span of one single generation, mine, the depression rate increased 10 times. People were 10 times more likely to be depressed if you're my age group than if you were in my parents' or grandparents' or great-grandparents' generation. About 5 years ago, that was a study done in the mid-80s, about 5 years ago, a massively funded sociological study was done on the American people, depression and happiness. It was published in newspapers across the country, and the results were covered by a professor at the University of Colorado named Tony Campos. And Campos made the following point. He said, imagine that 50 years from now, you will be, the average American family will have an income of $140,000 a year in those dollars, so increase that for inflation. And suppose further that the average life expectancy will have reached 85, and the typical 50-year-old will look and feel like a 35-year-old used to. And he said, if that's what you're imagining, that's today. He goes on to say, Americans today are, on average, twice as rich as they were 50 years ago, far healthier, more youthful, and safer than their predecessors. In other words, he says, the American dream that you'll be better off than your parents and your children will be better off than you keeps coming true. There's just one little problem with this rosy scenario. All this prosperity doesn't seem to have made Americans any happier. In fact, just the opposite has happened, with the happiness rate among Americans and the depression rate, again, leveling at about 10 to 12 times more frequently than in my parents', grandparents', and great-grandparents' generation. So what was discovered about the 60s generation held constant up until the current generation of Americans. And I think that covers most of us in this room. If you are if you were born since the boomers, and including the boomers, you are 10 times more likely to be anxiety and depression filled and to not be a happy person than your parents and grandparents and great grandparents. Now, this raises a very interesting question. Why? What's going on? Because if an epidemic breaks out of this sort in any area where you'd have a tenfold increase in heart disease, for example, or lung cancer in one generation, it would be an epidemic and people would be trying to figure out the etiology or the causal factors that gave rise to that. And so he basically says, what is wrong with Americans today? And his answer is that the American dream is based upon a fundamentally flawed picture of life. He goes on to argue that the American dream is basically the idea that if you have increasing levels of health, wealth, and liberty, freedom, you're going to be happy. And so then the goal will be to gain as much wealth as possible, to try to live a healthy, be physically healthy, and to have a political and social liberty, And if you can gain those things, you will be a happier person than someone without them. But he says, this is pretty obviously not working. And then he says, the real problem is that the American dream ought to be based not on those factors, but on a quest for meaning in life, on a search for some kind of meaning in life. Now, that raises another question, because I think that Campos is on to something with that answer. And I suspect you would agree that he's at least getting in the ballpark there. The problem is that this raises another question. The question is, why have Americans given up on trying to find meaning in life? Because Americans, by and large, have given up on trying to find meaning in life. If you, and I don't mean to offend anyone in here, please, but look, let's just be honest. If you witness or talk to the average American about eternal and important things, their lives are so filled with superficiality they can't relate to you in many occasions. They're preoccupied with day-to-day weekly things, and they don't spend any time thinking about ultimate questions. Americans have, by and large, given up on the quest for meaning in life. And I would like to ask Campos why, because he doesn't answer the question, neither does Seligman. I've tried to read in the literature on happiness why Americans have given up on the meaning in life, and so far I've not found a good answer to that question. I want to propose an answer this evening. I think a large reason Americans have given up on meaning in life is because of a change in worldview in American culture. And I'll explain what that change is. Before I do, though, I want to be very clear about something. I am not suggesting that whenever a person is depressed or filled with anxiety or they're not happy, it's because they don't have a good worldview. That's not my position. Indeed, I think some of the rise in depression and anxiety today is due to the pace of the life we live and the stress that follows from that pace. I think that we're tired and exhausted and stressed out as a people. And I think that's got something to do with it. But I do think that what you think matters. And as a result, I believe that a person's worldview is going to impact their happiness. So that if there is a change in happiness, one thing to look for might be a change in worldview. And I believe that there has been a shift in our culture since the 1960s from a worldview that provided meaning in life, namely a Christian worldview, which was largely held in the culture even by those that weren't explicitly believers. They still had a general framework that was Christian in orientation. There's been a shift from that worldview to another worldview called scientific naturalism. And that worldview does not allow for there to be such a thing as meaning in life. And because people have embraced scientific naturalism, sometimes without knowing they've done so, they've lost hope that there can be anything like meaning in life that would give them what is needed to be a happy and flourishing and highly functioning person. So what I want to do in the time I have left this evening is to do a little worldview analysis. Campos from the University of Colorado and Seligman from the University of Pennsylvania have put their finger on an important problem, that there's a loss of happiness due to a loss of meaning, but they have not provided, in my opinion, a deep fundamental analysis of why that's happened. And I believe that we Christians are called to think more deeply about these matters than our unbelieving friends. And so what I would like to do is to offer you a deeper analysis at the level of worldview for why there's been a shift in happiness due to a shift from a worldview that gives meaning in life to a worldview that can't give meaning in life. And I want to do this by analyzing for you the worldview of naturalism and how that impacts the ability or the inability to find meaning in life. And I can think of no other, a better way to do this than to do it through a text of Scripture. Now, by turning to this text of Scripture, I'm not only going to analyze the worldview of naturalism, but I'm going to give you an example of how Scripture engages in worldview thinking. And so we'll kill two birds with one stone this evening. The first thing that we'll be able to do is to understand why, the more our culture becomes secular and naturalistic, the less people will have happiness and meaning in life. That's one thing we'll see. The second thing we'll learn is that the Scriptures themselves analyze things at the level of worldview, and that the Bible is a deep, deep book indeed. Now, let me just ask so I can get a feel for where you're at. How many of you have a Bible with you that you can access? Okay, if you could. Okay, if you don't, please look on, because you're going to need to look at the text here. And I want you to turn to the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 1. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Ecclesiastes. That was a joke, ladies and gentlemen. Ecclesiastes chapter 1. While maintaining a tone of reverent inquiry, we are turning to the book of Ecclesiastes. I was just kidding. Now, I'm going to take you through one of the most intellectually sophisticated texts in the entire Bible. And you're going to have to really put on your thinking cap if you're going to get anything out of this, because this is heavy, heavy stuff indeed. Let's begin with the first two verses of Ecclesiastes chapter 1. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, everything is completely vain. Now, this is an incredibly pessimistic book. In fact, the book of Ecclesiastes is so pessimistic that at the Council of Jamnai around 90 AD, when Jewish rabbis gathered to reaffirm their commitment to which books belonged in the Old Testament, a large number of rabbis voted against the book of Ecclesiastes as not belonging in the Bible on the grounds that no book written by a believer could be this pessimistic. And I'll explain the pessimism to you in just a minute. The word, just to show you how pessimistic the book is, the word vain occurs in this book 37 times, and in the entire Old Testament outside Ecclesiastes, it only occurs 33 times. So there's more about vanity in this one little book, this one 12-chapter book, than the rest, the entire 38 other books of the Old Testament. Now, the word vain is very important, because this is going to be when I tell you what the word vain means, this is going to be a clue as to why the people in a secularized America can't find meaning in life. The Hebrew word for vain has two meanings. It means fleeting, and it means futile. So let's talk about those two meanings. Fleeting means instantaneous, not here for very long. The word was used of a person's breath in the morning. If you blow your breath on an eating utensil like that, your breath is there and gone. Your breath would be vain. It would not be there for very long. It's here and over with. And what Solomon is basically saying is that your life is a mess because it doesn't last for very long. You're here, and before you know it, you're dead. And I can tell you, the closer I get to the other side, the more I realize how fast life goes. And those of us that are nodding are all gray-haired. It really is the truth that life goes very quickly. And the rest of you have dyed your hair, ma'am. So, I mean, gray hair. So. Don't try to fight the inevitable, please. But, all right. I don't want to tangle with that lady. I can already tell. All right. So, let me quickly move on. The other thing that vain means is futile. Now, by futile, that means without any purpose. So to be vain is not to have a purpose. And to illustrate this, in the book, Solomon actually says on one occasion that if I had a choice between being after birth and being a live baby, I'd rather be after birth. And the reason is, neither one has any purpose in life. There's no meaning to us, and there's no meaning to afterbirth. At least the afterbirth doesn't have to go through a life of pain and suffering. It's pretty bleak. Pretty bleak outlook. Now, you step back and to say, how can he say that I don't have any purpose to my life? How can he say my life's fleeting when there's life after death? The answer is that Solomon is writing from the perspective of an atheist or a naturalist. He is writing from the perspective of under the sun or under heaven. And if you take a quick look at verse 3, you'll see the phrase, under the sun. Verse 9, same thing, under the sun, under heaven. The phrase, under the sun, under heaven, occurs all throughout this book. So what you have to understand is that Solomon is adopting a standpoint in this book of modern-day naturalism. He's basically saying, let's pretend the physical world is all there is, that there is no God, and that the world that you see around you is all there is. And on that assumption, let's ask the question as to whether there's any purpose to life. And his answer is, on that assumption, under heaven or under the sun, there is absolutely, human life is absolutely vain because we're not here very long, there's no afterlife. And we weren't put in the world for a purpose. There's no purpose to life whatsoever. Now, he is not content to leave this at the level of assertion. What he's going to do now is he's going to prove this. He's going to give an argument, believe it or not, for these claims. Remember, the claim is that we're in trouble because our lives are really brief and there's no purpose why we're here. Those are the two problems we've got. And he's now going to give an argument for why those are problems in a naturalistic worldview. And here we land into four of the most sophisticated verses that you will find in the entire Old Testament. Let's read them together. Verse 3. What advantage does a man have in all of his work, which he does under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. Also, the sun rises and the sun sets, and hastening toward its place, it rises there again, blowing toward the south, then turning toward the north. The wind continues swirling along, and on its circular courses, the wind returns. All the rivers flow into the sea, yet the sea is not full. Now, when you look at that, you're liable to think, what in the heck is that? what's he talking about? It's unbelievable what he's talking about. Look at it again and tell me, don't say it out loud, but suppose I were giving you a test. What is the subject that he's talking about? What subject matter is he talking about in these three or four verses? Just go back and look at it for a second and see if you can find the subject matter. Okay, did you find it? What is the, don't say it out loud, but just ask, what is the subject he's talking about? And let me tell you what it is. You ready? It's four things. Air, earth, fire, and water. Those are his subject matter. Why? Because those were the four chemical elements of the ancient Near Eastern world. And what he is saying is that if God does not exist and the physical world is all there is, then you are stuck with a worldview known as atomism. Everything is composed of atoms and molecules. That's all there is. Only in his day, it wouldn't have been that we were composed of carbon, hydrogen, and nitrogen. We would have been composed of earth, air, fire, and water. So this is what is being taught in the public schools in chemistry classes. This is being taught at Ohio State in chemistry classes. This is being taught in our universities that everything is composed of the periodic table. Now, I'm inclined to think atoms exist, but, I mean, on my better days. On other days, I'm honestly not so sure, because it's possible to take chemical theory in an anti-realist way, which basically is the idea that chemical theory is a useful fiction. It works, it makes accurate predictions, but it's not true. So it's an open question as to whether the periodic table really describes reality. But 5 days out of the week, I think it does. So then on my other 2 days, I'm cranky. So basically, but it's not a silly question. I had a professor at USC did not believe in any of the periodic table. And this guy knew all the chemistry that anybody knows. So you're not an idiot for not believing in that stuff. But let's grant it for the sake of argument. What we have is the idea that everything is composed of carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, potassium. You get the point. And what he is saying is that if God doesn't exist and the physical world is all there is, everything is made out of air, earth, fire, and water. Now, why does he make that point? Remember one of the problems with human beings? One of the problems with meaning in life is that our lives don't last very long. We're fleeting. Now, you tell me which is more fleeting on this view, a human being or the element carbon? Which is going to last longer? Carbon. So which has a better chance of meaning in life, carbon or me? See, so automatically he's saying, if God doesn't exist, why should you think human life is so special? Probably, if anything is going to have meaning in a godless world, it's going to be our creators, which are the fundamental forces of nature. You know, if you take hydrogen and oxygen and put them together, they form water. Remember that? Now, does hydrogen and oxygen still exist while the water exists? Yeah. When you break water back down, does the water still exist? What does exist? Hydrogen and oxygen. Which is more permanent? What creates the water? The hydrogen and oxygen. What creates everything? The fundamental elements of the natural world. So his point is that in a godless world, and if we're looking for meaning, probably the thing that would have meaning wouldn't be we, because we're very temporary. It would probably be nature, or the fundamental forces of nature themselves. Now, does air, earth, fire, and water have meaning? Even though they're permanent and we're not, does air, earth, fire, and water have meaning? And his answer is no, because verse 7, the sea is not full. Now, here's where we're going to have to step back and understand the worldview that he's talking about here. We've got to go back to Aristotle. Aristotle made a distinction between an efficient cause and a final cause. An efficient cause is something that produces an effect. Can you guys stay with me? Are we okay? Are we feeling any love? Okay. All right. I told you this would be tough, and it is. So what's an efficient cause? An efficient cause is something that produces an effect. All right? What's a final cause? It is a purpose or a goal for why something happens. Okay? Now take boiling water. Why is the water boiling? Told in terms of efficient causes, I would say, again, because the gas on the stove is combusting, and that's causing it to absorb energy. That energy is being absorbed by the liquid water, which is agitating the molecules, which is causing them to get so agitated they escape into the gas phase. That's why the water is boiling. Notice that answer is an answer told in terms of efficient causes, where you tell one thing causing another, which causes another, which causes another. Do you understand that? I could also say the water is boiling so that we could have tea. And that is actually why the water is boiling. But that is to answer the question in terms of the purpose for why water is boiling. Do you understand the goal or the purpose? Now, you've got to understand that in an atomistic worldview, where the only thing that exists are atoms and molecules in the physical world, there are no final causes. There are only efficient causes. Nothing happens for a purpose. One of the main results of the Darwinian revolution was that biologists stopped claiming that the organs that are a part of living things function for a reason. So that things don't have eyes so that they can see. Instead, Darwin told a story about how the eye evolved in terms of efficient causes. Now, the point is that in a godless world and in a contemporary secular culture that's buying a naturalist worldview, it's going to be increasingly difficult to believe that there's any meaning to the world, because if anything lasts long, it's not going to be human beings, it's going to be our Creator, which will be the fundamental forces of nature that we're made of. And not even that has any meaning, because history's one darn thing after another. It's just air, earth, fire, and water obeying the laws of nature and physics and chemistry without the sea being full. In other words, these atoms, air, earth, fire, and water, swirl and move, but there is no goal for why they do what they do, which would be to fill the sea. These things don't happen for a final cause. There's no end point. There's no purpose. There's no goal. There's no telos for why air, earth, fire, and water do what they do. Air, earth, fire, and water just come together and form you and me, lions and tigers and dogs and ducks and so on, trees, galaxies. They break apart again. They come back and form new things. They break apart again. The air, earth, fire, and water is always here, but there's no overarching goal for why any of this happens. And he speaks specifically of water. This water doesn't behave so that it will fill the sea. That would have been a final cause. And that would apply to all four, air, earth, fire, and water. None of these things do what they do for a reason. And that's why there's no meaning in life if you've accepted this worldview of naturalism. Let me illustrate this. Stephen Jay Gould, you may know, passed away, but he was one of the leading atheistic evolutionary paleontologists in the world at Harvard University. He was asked by Life magazine, why are we here? Now, what kind of a question is why are we here, would you say? Is that a question for an efficient cause, or is that a question for a final cause or a purpose? It's pretty obvious that if somebody is saying why are we here, they're asking, is there a reason why we were put into the world? Aren't they? Listen to Gould's answer with insight now. Gould says the following. We are here because one odd group of fishes had a particular fin anatomy that could transform into legs for terrestrial creatures, because the earth never froze entirely during an ice age, because a small and tenuous species arising in Africa a quarter of a million years ago has managed so far to survive by hook and by crook. We may yearn for a higher answer, but there is no such answer. What did he answer when he answered the question, why are we here? He told the story in terms of efficient causes, because Gould knew that if God was dead and atheistic evolution were true, there were no final causes. We're not here for a purpose. So instead, he told a story of how we got here. which is pretty empty and barren. So his answer is, there's not a purpose for why we're here. We're here because this is how evolution produced this, and that's the end of the story. There's, by the way, a sequel. When he passed away, all of his atheistic biology and science buddies attended his funeral, and at his eulogy, they all spoke about final causes. Stephen Jay Gould gave his life for the purpose of science education. He gave his life so that people would be dispelled from ignorance. They couldn't bring themselves to talk meaninglessness at his funeral. Now, remember Jeffrey Dahmer, who is a cannibalizing serial killer? Remember the interview with Stone Phillips on television before he was killed in prison? I'll never forget it because Phillips asked Dahmer, "Why did you start doing this to people?" Dahmer said, "Look, everybody watching this show has desires. They all have things they want. And they're all going to try to satisfy their desires unless they've got a good reason not to." And I think, well, that's true. I'll try to satisfy my desires unless I've got an overriding reason not to. So he said, "When I was a boy, I began torturing animals, and I found it met my needs. And I began to graduate toward more severe forms of torture. I had given up belief in God, so I didn't believe that I was here for a purpose." And good for him, that's right. "Instead, I evolved from slime, efficient cause. And when I die, I will return back to slime, efficient cause. Morality is just a human invention. And so I couldn't find any good reason why, since there's no punishment after death, I should say no to my desires. And I found that cannibalizing human beings was the next step in my needs." And I'm sitting there thinking, I think he's right. Honestly, I think that he is basically living out what Stephen Jay Gould said in Life magazine. If God is dead, it's air, earth, fire, and water, and that's it. It's atoms and molecules obeying the laws of nature without any telos or purpose to any of it. And Gould said, "Well, if there isn't a God and it's just from slime back to slime, and I've got 75 to 80 years here, why shouldn't I do anything I want to do as long as I don't get caught?" And I think that he's grasped accurately the inner logic of atheistic naturalism. My view is that the profs who teach this stuff at Ohio State ought to follow suit. He just had the guts to act out his worldview. They don't. Okay? Now let me illustrate it one more time, and I want to move to a couple other passages here. One of them, I think, is going to blow your mind. It really did me when I first saw it. Suppose I invited you to my house to play Monopoly, and that's an old game. Some of you don't know what it is. Ah, my head's exploding. Okay, so and you came over, and I said, "We're going to play Monopoly, but it's going to be a little bit different. There's the Monopoly board. Over there is a coin. You can flip the coin if you'd like when it's your turn. There's a set of jacks. You can toss the jack ball and pick up some jacks. There's the refrigerator. Fix something to eat. There's a remote for the TV. When it's your turn, you can just do anything you want to do." So you start off the game and you think, this is going to be wonderful. You put hotels all over the board, and it's my turn. I get up and I dump the board upside down and flip a coin up in the air. Okay, you think, okay, I'm trying this again. You put hotels again on the board, and you gradually push the board over to me and say, it's your turn. I sweep the board clean with my hand. I turn on the television and fix a sandwich again. Now, it wouldn't take long until something would dawn on you. It's what dawned on Dahmer. And what would dawn on you would be that it wouldn't really matter what you did when it was your turn. And here's why. If the game as a whole doesn't have a purpose, the individual moves within the game are meaningless. If the sea is not full, if there's no overarching purpose to why this world was put here, then when it's your turn, it's your life, it doesn't ultimately matter what you do. Because at the end of the day, life is indeed, at the fundamental level, meaningless, and that will lead to depression and a loss of happiness as more and more people face the implications of an atheistic, naturalistic view of the world. Now, you might think, well, maybe I could find happiness by education. Maybe what I should do if God doesn't exist is try to get an education. Solomon considers that alternative starting in verse 12. in chapter 1. Let's read this. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem. I set my mind to seek and explore by wisdom concerning all that has been done under heaven. It is a grievous task which God has given to the sons of men to be afflicted with. I have seen all the works which have been done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and striving after wind. What is crooked cannot be straightened, and what is lacking cannot be counted. So I said to myself, behold, I have magnified and increased wisdom more than all of those who were over Jerusalem before me, and my mind has observed a wealth of wisdom and knowledge. So he tried to become as educated as he could. And I set my mind to know wisdom and to know madness and folly, and I realized that this also is striving after wind, because in much wisdom there's much grief, and increased knowledge results in increased pain. Folks, it's stupid to get an education in a world where there's no God. Doesn't make any sense. And the reason is because what is crooked can't be straightened. Now, I want you to take a look at the key verse, verse 15. What is crooked cannot be straightened, and what is lacking cannot be counted. Now, what does he mean by that? You could have straight things without crooked things, but you can't have crooked things without straight things, because crookedness is an absence of straightness. Let me say it again. There could be straightness without any crookedness, but God himself couldn't create a world where there was crookedness without straightness, because crookedness can only be crooked in comparison to what is straight. He is saying that in a world without God, there can be no standards. There's nothing that makes things straight. Why get an education to try to fix things that are crooked when there's no notion of straightness? And this is why, since about the 1930s, and there is a great book on this called The Making of the Modern University by Julie Rubin, a professor at Harvard, who basically says, and she's not a believer, she basically says that from 1880 to 1930, our universities went from Christian liberal arts colleges to modern research universities. And as a result of abandoning a Judeo-Christian view of the world, the universities became pluralversities. You now have no unity. If you go to Ohio State and major in something, there's no unity to the curriculum any longer. It's a fragmented place. The only thing that unifies universities and forms communities around them these days are the sports teams. Good luck with Jim Trussell. Well, yeah, get out of town. Get out of town. Okay, that's enough of that. But what has happened is the university has lost its reason for existing. You want to know why universities really exist today? Here it is: to certify, to grant credentials. That's it. It has the power to give a doctorate or a master's degree or a bachelor's degree. And the university exists to be a granting agency. But there is no telos for the university. There are for Christian colleges, but not for secular schools, because they don't know what they're about. Interesting proof of this. The former dean of Yale Law School, Thomas Koenig, wrote a book a few years ago claiming that since the 60s, the university has lost the ability to ask questions that really matter. Like, is there a meaning to life? Is there a purpose to all this? And he says, I kid you not, he basically says what Solomon is saying, though I don't think he's read Solomon, but he basically says the university has lost its ability to talk about is there meaning in life, because the university has bought the idea that science and the material world is all there is. And if the material world is all there is, there's no overarching purpose to anything. So the university has given up on that question. His recommendation? Start studying the great books of Western culture. My question is, why? And the answer is because of the worldview that comes from those books. It is largely a monotheistic, even Christian worldview that is communicated by those great books. But the university is in deep trouble. which is what you'd predict if they abandoned Christianity. You're tricked into thinking it's not true because Ohio State's got a lot of money and they can sustain research in their systems. So you think everything's going on well over there. Don't believe it. It's not true. It's not true. There's chaos in the Western University. On the news two nights ago, they did a study where it shows that student cheating is just off the charts these days. And they interviewed this one student, and he said, well, what's the big deal about this? Values have just shifted in culture, and now everybody's doing it, and our values have just changed. And I'm thinking, he gets it. He gets air, earth, fire, and water. If the natural world is all there is, values are just cultural constructions, because what is crooked can't be straightened, because there's no standard of straightness. Now, education would be a bad joke in a godless university, if you ask me. By the way, the only reason I'd ever go for education, and if God didn't exist, was power. That would be it. Power. Money and power. No, I think there's a better alternative, and Solomon deals with it in the next chapter, and that's pleasure. If God didn't exist, I'd be more inclined to live for pleasure than education. So here's what he says. I said to myself, come now, verse 1 of chapter 2, I will test you with pleasure, so enjoy yourself, and it was futility. I said of laughter, it's madness, and pleasure, what does it accomplish? And so in verse 3, he tries wine. In verse 4, 5, 6, 7, he tries aesthetic beauty, so he surrounds himself with art objects and the beauty of nature. He tries sex in verse 7, where he surrounds himself with female, verse 8 rather, with female concubines. Verse 10, he basically says, all that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them, and I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart was pleased because of all my labor, and that was my reward for all my labor. And he basically concludes that this is nothing but striving after wind. In a godless world, if the purpose of your life is pleasure, you're a sad person. Now, listen very carefully to me. If God doesn't exist, I can understand still wanting to have some pleasure. I'm not saying that. I am saying if God doesn't exist, to make pleasure my aim in life, as opposed to wanting to enjoy it now and then, would be a foolish thing to do. And let me tell you why. Everybody knows that if a person lives his life solely for pleasure, they are to be pitied, not envied. Illustration, have you ever heard somebody have a little baby that they just had born and they take that little baby and look into the little baby's eyes and say, you know, little Ashley, I hope that you grow up to be a self-absorbed, narcissistic, pleasure-seeking person. Or if you're at Uncle Harry's funeral and you're given a eulogy, no matter what's true, you're not going to say, well, old Uncle Harry sure knew how to live for himself and seek pleasure, and that was about it. No, you're going to eulogize the guy, right? Because if you say that I just want this little baby to grow up and be a self-absorbed, narcissistic pleasure seeker, or if you say that of Uncle Harry, you are understanding that their lives would be a tragic mistake. See, I spoke a few years ago at a penthouse apartment in Hollywood to a group of about 70 people from the movie industry. There was a believer in the movie industry that decided to have a six-month series on the great books of the Western world with Christian themes. And I was asked to speak one evening on the meaning of life. And I got there, and there were about 70 people, and I was told by some of the folks that put it on that probably a third or so of the people were non-Christians. It was a very interesting gathering. And I began, and I said, look, I want to say something controversial, I said to the audience, because I hope we can get an engaged discussion a little bit later. But I said, I think most of you know that what you do for a living doesn't matter. And I said, the reason I know that about you is that you are also desperately in search of some political or moral cause to give your life purpose. Because if all you live for is money and pleasure, you know you've wasted your life, and so you're trying to find some higher purpose. And it has to be, you know, saving the environment, or whatever it might be. Now, I also said, by the way, I think that you select your purpose unthinkingly, and here's why I think that. because you all end up being so left-leaning, politically left in your views. Now, I said, what does being a movie producer have to do with being leftist? I mean, nothing. The only way I can explain your all being leftist is you're homogeneous and engaging in groupthink. You opt for your views based on peer pressure in Hollywood, not because of independent thought, or else there'd be more diversity among you. Now, I said, I swear I did. And I said, now, I was kind of joking with him. I said, now, you could say if Christians, well, aren't you guys groupthink too? Because you all end up with the same views about abortion and so on. I said, there's a huge difference between us. I said, with Christianity, there is an intellectual ideology you buy into when you become a Christian. So it's no surprise that we agree about fundamental things, because if we didn't, we wouldn't have bought the ideology in the first place. But there is no ideology for being a cameraman or anything else. So I can't explain your homogeneity based on the inner logic of the ideas, but based upon social factors. So anyway, so when I did, I at least felt better. But I basically said that you understand that if you live your life for pleasure and that's all, that your life has been a waste, and you hunger for there to be some bigger purpose to give your life meaning and purpose. And that's a good thing. Now, the question is there such a thing? And then I made a case for God on that. Okay. Now, let me illustrate this, and then I'll summarize, and we'll have a little time for Q&A. So if you have a question or you'd like to ask, you might want to be thinking about that. But let me illustrate this pleasure thing through a little story I like to tell about a guy named Juan Mug. I told my class this story, but I think it's very effective. Juan Mug, W-O-N-M-U-G. I make up a weird name because this is a fictitious little guy. I'm going to beat up on him pretty badly. So here it goes. Juan Mug graduated from high school, and he was an absolute idiot. He could add and subtract barely, but he couldn't multiply and divide. But he wanted to go to college and major in physics. So he applied and got accepted at Ohio State. He got in at University of Michigan. Okay, there we go. All right. Now, so he takes his first exam, and he gets 3 out of 100 right. And it's just ridiculous. So the professor calls an emergency meeting, doesn't let Juan Mug know about it, has all the physics majors and faculty come to the meeting and says, look, we got this dunce kid, freshman Juan Mug. This guy's a dunce. Let's make him think for the next 4 years he's the smartest student to ever come and study here. And all the while, we'll mock this guy behind his back and we'll have a great joke at his expense. They all agree. So the guy ends up going through 4 years of college, graduates magna cum laude. The guy's an idiot. He doesn't know anything. Everybody's mocking, hates his guts behind his back. He's so encouraged, he goes on and gets a PhD. They email all the scientists in the world. They're all in on the spoof. This guy ends up occupying a chair of physics at a major university, supervises 10 dissertations a year, is interviewed by Time and Newsweek, goes to national security conferences in particle physics to represent national interests. And this guy is a joke. He's a laughing stock. Now, the question is, would you like to be Juan Mug? And I'm thinking, you're saying, gosh, no. But remember, there's something true about him. He's the happiest guy on the face of the earth. His beliefs give him pleasure. Because he goes to bed at night and he says, I am significant. People adore my work. My doctoral students are lucky to be studying under me. I'm serving my country with distinction. I am admired for the quality of my work all over the world. Juan Mug's beliefs work for him. There's only one problem with them. They're false. Now, the point is, the reason that you don't envy Juan Mug is because even though he has pleasure in his life, he doesn't have any real meaning. And if you agree that he is to be pitied, not envied, you're telling me that even though pleasure may be a good thing, it can't be the ultimate reason why we're here. Because if that's all there is to this life, it is vanity and striving after wind. By the way, if you live for pleasure, you end up not having it. Whereas if you live for what's right, you end up getting more pleasure than you do if you live for pleasure. It's one of those odd things. Now, what I'm saying is, in the book of Ecclesiastes, we actually have an example of worldview argumentation. We have this man arguing about the nature of philosophical naturalism and its inadequacy to provide meaning in life. He is basically claiming that if naturalism is true and God doesn't exist, everything is made of atoms and molecules. He calls it air, earth, fire, and water. And they obey the laws of nature and chemistry and physics. They swirl in their courses. But the sea is never full. They don't do what they do for any purpose or goal or meaning. And education can't solve the problem because what's crooked can't be straightened. If there aren't any standards for what life is supposed to be like, how can I set up standards for making human progress in terms of human flourishing? Colleges will end up becoming technology and business schools. And what about pleasure? Pleasure's a wonderful thing if there's a God, because there's more to life than pleasure. But if God doesn't exist, pleasure's all there is, and that's a bad joke. That's sad. And so we have people today stuck. They're stuck. They don't have any hope that there's any... When Campos and Sullivan say people are depressed and they're not happy because they've given up on meaning, I want to scream and say, why? It's because they're buying the view that there is ultimately not a real God that you can know. That religion is a fairy tale, it's superstition, it's not real. Therefore, they've lost hope that there's meaning in life. And instead, they've hunkered down to living a week at a time, just managing their budget and making sure the kids are at soccer, and that's it. And that is a life that's going nowhere in a hurry. The only solution to the problem is for people to be confronted in a kind way with the Judeo-Christian biblical view of the world and for them to embrace discipleship unto Jesus Christ. Then they have a reasonable hope for meaning in life, and then they can go ahead and go to their soccer and do other things because it fits a part of a bigger picture. It's not an end in itself. Let's pray together, and then we'll have a chance for a question or two. Lord, I'm thankful that you have not left us here without purpose. We are made to hunger for purpose. We really do hunger for it. And we thank you that because you're real and your son is alive, that there's a meaning to why we're here. No person in this room is an accident. Nobody was cast into this world by a random accident. We've all been put in the world by you as the grand conductor to play a role in the symphony at this particular place in space and time in a way that nobody else could play it. We just ask for your help to play it well. Help us play our role well. And to do it for the glory of your son, Jesus, in his name, amen. Thank you very much, and thank you. Don't you love being a Christian? I mean, really? Isn't it unbelievable? I tell you. Okay, why don't we have a chance to just interact a little bit? And I can't really see. There's a hand down here, and I don't have control of the mic. So somebody want to get on the mic? Is there a mic somewhere?
Yeah, right.
Okay. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, I know that to say that belief in God is the basis for morality isn't to say
no,
that...
No, I didn't say belief in God is the basis of morality. Let me just clarify something here. Belief in God isn't the basis of morality. God is. So if God exists, there is morality. So that even if you're an atheist but God still exists, there's a basis for morality, namely the existence of God. But go ahead.
Right. So, you know, atheists may argue, well, I still have ethics and stuff. And
yeah, but they can't justify them. Atheists can say, I have ethics, but I'd like to ask, where do they come from and why?
Right.
Because you feel that way?
And they can follow a set of morals and stuff, and that's cool. But I know I studied philosophy at Ohio State, and I often heard that it's ridiculous to think that God would be the exclusive basis for real objective morals. Can you tell us like what the most popular or the main kind of contenders for a worldview that has ethical values that doesn't include God?
Yeah. There's only one worldview that has the possibility of objective moral values apart from a theistic worldview, and that's called a Platonic realism. It's basically the idea that moral values are simply there, and they're part of the furniture of the universe. They're just a part of the universe, that they don't come from God, they're just there, and that they somehow appear in the history of the cosmos at certain points. This is an attempt to argue that there could be objective moral values without there being any God that's needed to create them. There are too many problems with the view for me to go into. I've criticized it in a book that I've written called The Recalcitrant Imago Dei, where I've got a chapter on why this doesn't work. Evolution undermines it. The theory of evolution undercuts the ability of the human mind to know what those values are, so that even if they existed, we could not have any knowledge of what they were. Because our faculties are forged in the struggle for survival, not for truth. And so that's a problem. But it's a good, that would be the worldview, Platonic realism. I can't, just whoever, I'll let you guys with the microphone. How about here and then this sister here? Okay, you first, ma'am. You go.
Okay. What would be a good way to present God to somebody who's a humanist or a secular in their thinking, but they're looking for meaning?
I think what would be a good way to present a Christian view to a humanist that's looking for meaning? The first thing I would do would be to say, I really applaud your quest. And I would say, so many people are just so lazy today that don't care about it, and I really respect your quest. And then I would say, I believe that there is help in your quest that a lot of people have rejected, not you necessarily, but a lot of people have rejected because they've misunderstood it as religion. And it seems boring and religious and a bunch of goody-two-shoes stuff. And I want you to know that the greatest adventure that you could ever have is following Jesus of Nazareth. And I'd like to ask you to consider following him and just at least be willing to consider it. Now, I wrote a book for a guy like this called The God Question. I recommended it this afternoon. I don't know if they have any left in the bookstore, but it's called The God Question, and it was written to give to an unbeliever that's willing to listen to a case and think about it. If this guy'd be at least willing to listen, get him a copy and give it to him and see what he says.
Okay.
That's kind of how I'd go about it.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks for asking.
Hey, Mr. Moreland.
There was a lady over. Oh, yes.
Yeah. I guess the reason why I wanted to talk to you is because I can identify with Juan Mug, because it sounds like my life a lot. I got saved when I was 18.
What? I didn't hear you.
I got saved. I received Jesus Christ in my heart when I was 18 years old.
Yeah. Yeah.
Went to college, got involved with campus ministry, served the Lord there. But I guess the thing is, like, after college, I got a teaching job.
Yeah.
Went on and I got my master's. Okay. And I feel a lot like, you know, I'm identifying a lot with the humanistic side of making a difference. Okay.
Okay.
And I guess to cut to the chase, where I'm at right now with my life is I'm on this brink of making a major decision, and that is, should I move to Nashville, Tennessee, and pursue my music career, or should I stay here and be a teacher? And I guess why I'm giving this to you is because, like, I identify so much with this, and I'm so torn. You know,
sure,
because, like,
sure.
the whole reason I'd want to be a musician is just so I can give it all away. You know, so, I mean...
Well, let me help you with something, if I may. First of all, I really admire you. I think it took tremendous courage for you to be honest about what you just said. And I respect and admire you for your honesty. Thank you for that, number one. Number two, you know, this might be of help to you. I think there's a difference between self-centeredness and rational self-interest. It is possible for a person to have rational self-interest. If you actually are made in God's image, then you ought to take care of yourself because you're valuable. You ought to be concerned about your life. You ought to care about what happens to you. You ought to want to feel joy in your work. You ought to want to be fulfilled in the things you do. Those are normal, and those aren't self-centered. The difference would be that if you're engaged in rational self-interest, you are intelligently and reasonably wanting what's best for you. If you're doing that appropriately, that's not your only concern. You also want to give your life away to help others. You want to serve the kingdom of God. You believe that other people have value, and you want to respect and love and give yourself to them as well. The wine mug guy is somebody who can only care about himself and doesn't care for anybody else. And you don't, I don't know you, but from what I'm hearing, you don't strike me as that kind of a guy. You actually strike me as a fairly deep person who's struggling at a pretty deep level with your choices. And I'm saying to you that there's nothing wrong with doing things because you enjoy them and they're in your self-interest, as long as that's not the only thing you're thinking about. And so if you love music and you want to give it away, I would be presumptuous. Like, I don't know what you should do, but I wouldn't rule that out just because you love it. That would actually be a good indication to do it, as far as I'm concerned. But all right, thanks.
Oh,
appreciate your
voice. Am I on? All right, sweet. I have a quick question. It's, I don't know if it's necessarily tied to the efficient versus final causes thing, but I run into a lot of people who, when I'm asking them about worldviews and trying to dialogue about, you know, an answer, they end up saying, well, for me, it's just all about searching for it. And they just take this position of the perpetual searcher.
Yeah.
And never come to an answer. Do you have any advice on how to help that person find an answer?
Right. Number one, virtually no journey is worth anything except for the goal it's set out to reach. So you think of any journey. Think of exercising. The reason that exercising is a good thing is because there's a purpose to it. It restores your health or makes you better at a sport or something like that. The reason you go to law school the reason you take that search and that journey is so that you can become a good lawyer and make a living out of it, or something of that sort. So what I would start would be to say, look, let's forget about religion for a minute, and let's just face the fact that your view doesn't really explain much of life, because most of what people do, they embark on searches for a goal or an end of some kind. And if it's an endless search without there being the possibility of achieving a goal, it kind of seems meaningless to me. Here's the other thing I would say. If I wouldn't say this to the person, but I would just tell you that people who say things like that are usually, not always, but usually looking for an excuse for inactivity. They don't want to make choices. They want to be able to continue doing what they want to do without the pressure to change or make a choice. So I'm a searcher lets me off the hook without having to be responsible for anything, because I'm a searcher, and it's kind of chic to be a searcher. So I'm also a cool person. I'm sort of a cool searcher. And as a result, I don't need to be responsible for anything, and I don't have to make any choices or decisions. That would be a worry I would have about this individual. Let's have one more, and then I'm going to need to take off. So by the way, when I take off, I'm going to have to leave. I'm sorry about that. But this dear lady back here, sorry. Yes, ma'am.
I have friends that are just completely apathetic about anything about life. Like the idea of God or even, I guess, a meaning. I don't know, they're just okay with apathy. Like, what do I say to them about that?
It's difficult. There are two things you can do. Number one, lead a horse to water. You can't make him drink, but you can feed him salt. What that means is I have no idea, but it was really a great saying. Basically, what you need to do as best as you can, without being perfect, because you don't have to be perfect, But just be on fire for Jesus and for the things that matter to you, and let them see that in you. And they're watching you. They'll watch. And they'll see your fire and passion. And I can guarantee you that isn't going to go unnoticed. That's number one. The second thing is, you can sit down and say, let's suppose the person's name is Shelley. You can say, Shelley, I got to tell you, as your friend, I love you so much. I'm very, very worried about you. And I just got to tell you that because I love you. And here's what I'm worried about. You don't seem to be living for anything. You seem to just kind of be drifting. And I've seen that when people drift, they don't end up in good places. And I want you to end up in a good place. And I'm just worried that your apathy is going to cause you to drift. And I love you too much to just let it go. I had to say something to you. You might want to try something like that. But apart from that, that's the best I can give you. Hey, folks, thank you very much. Blessings on you.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.